Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk, featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within London's West End. Today's episode is about the senseless death of Reginald Gordon West. An innocent man, in the wrong place at the wrong time, for a very innocent reason. Oddly, he never saw his killers, he never heard his killers, and stranger still, he would never meet his killers. Murder Mile is researched using the original police files. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 60, Reginald Gordon West, The Birthday Party and the Spent Penny. Today, I'm standing on Lyle Street, WC2, one street east of the Latin Quarter nightclub, where the murder of David Knight led to a mafia hit and Alfredo Zamperelli, two streets south of the Piccadilly Hotel, where the first bungled assassination on Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko irradiated an entire room, and a few doors down from the infamous Rosendale murder. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Lyle Street is a thin pedestrianised road wedged between Shaftesbury Avenue and Leicester Square, with the north side being a mix of oriental eateries, noisy gay bars and discreet brothels, and the south side little more than a featureless wall, being the back end of such cultural delights as the Hippodrome, Warner Cinema and M&M World. Rarely bathed in sunlight, Lyle Street is dark and shadowy, a seedy side street slathered in gloom and menace. Illuminated by the fizz of tacky neon signs, echoing with the deafening clatter of cobblestones, and dripping in the beery stench of frothy urine, as a drunk expels his pee just 2 feet from a portaloo, only to exclaim,
"Yeah, fuck's sake,"
having tripped over one of 50 bin bags, or slipped in yet another dog shit. Today, Lyle Street is home to the Beijing Dumpling, a tasty little dumpling house set in a thin, four-storey brownstone building on a long curved terrace, with a small restaurant on the ground floor and a side door to the flats above. It's warm, friendly, and the food's good. But if you breathe deeply, there may be an odd smell you can't quite put your finger on. As it was here, on Monday the 25th of April 1966, on the second floor of 23 Lyle Street, where the life of Reginald Gordon West would end at the hands of three killers, none of whom he would ever meet. On Tuesday the 26th of April 1966, 49-year-old George Ellerington West entered a vague red brick building at number 65 Horse Ferry Road, 2 miles south of Soho. being blonde, thin, and medium build. Although he spoke well and held himself with a middle-class decorum, George's eyes were etched with shock, sadness, and dread for what he was about to see. As this was Westminster Coroner's Court, where death inquests are held, and in a mortuary below, where the bodies are laid. Being stark, clean, and cold, the softly spoken voices of George, Dr. Tear, and Detective Superintendent Walker echoed across the steel fridges and the white-tiled walls of the morgue with an eerie reverb. As D.S. Walker asked,
"George, do you recognize any of these personal effects?"
On a small side table, several strangely familiar items were laid out like a bad jumble sale. A shoe, a hanky, two pens, a pair of spectacles, and a watch. Except everything was black and sooty, broken and snapped. Several tiny fragments of a life destroyed. Seeing a charred, size 8 hand-stitched shoe, two shattered pieces of horn-rimmed glasses, and a white metal wristwatch. The glass smashed, the face black, and the warped hands forever trapped at 7:35 p.m. The police knew who they belonged to, as inside the victim's pocket, between his burned jacket, his scorched shirt, and his seared flesh, lay a brown leather wallet. The contents barely legible, but unmistakable. As except for 4 1-pound notes and 10 shillings, they found a membership card to the Pen and Wig Club, a signed cheque for £25, a parking permit for Somerset House, and 4 Inland Revenue payslips, all in the name of Mr. R.G. West. But given their state, George said,
"They look familiar, but I can't be certain. I'm sorry."
All the while, his eyes darted towards the gurney, as on top lay a thick white shroud, draped over a life-sized lump. D.S. Walker asked,
"Ready, George?"
He nodded. Not ready, but knowing that with no other next of kin, this job was down to him. And as Dr. Tear pulled down the shroud to the neck, now he could see the face. Only there was no face, no features. This wasn't human, it was an outline. A silhouette of a person Gordon once loved, who was alive yesterday and dead today. His once pale skin scorched charcoal black and oddly smooth. His new cologne like burnt plastics and pig fat. And his soft blonde hair now singed and shriveled. As before him lay an unrecognizable shadow with no lips, no lashes and no eyes. George couldn't connect the two. This silent blackened corpse and his big brother. And as George stood over his brother's charred remains, the morgue was tinged with an eerie silence, as two strikingly similar men, same height, weight, and size, were face to face for the final time. Only, like a photograph and its negative, one was blonde and alive, and the other was black and dead. D.S. Walker asked,
"George, I know this is hard, but is this Reginald?"
And with tears of both sorrow and frustration, George replied,
"I don't know if that's my brother. I just can't tell."
Reginald Gordon West died a truly horrifying death, having been burned alive. And although this was unequivocally proved to be him, one question still stood. Who had killed him, and why? The morning of Monday, the 25th of April, 1966, was dry and clear, as a light northeasterly wind whipped up the dust and litter up off the streets. And being 3 degrees hotter than the monthly average, unusually, it had rained very little. You may ask why a weather report is so important to the case, but it is. At 9:30 a.m., three young men, Roger, Robert and David, excitedly hopped onto the Bakerloo tube line at Kilburn Park in North London and headed nine stops south to Piccadilly Circus. Their spirits were high, their banter was jovial, and their mood was fun. And for good reason. Being a workday, although they each earned an honest living as a cabinet maker, a musician, and a sales clerk, as three close friends, raised a few doors apart, and educated side by side, all three had taken the day off, as today was Roger's 21st birthday. Half a mile east, having driven up from his home in Champion Hill, South London, 54-year-old Reginald Gordon West parked his car in his usual spot at Somerset House on the Strand and began his job as a civil servant for the Inland Revenue. Being a different age, class, occupation, and raised in different parts of the city, Reginald had never met, spoke, or heard of either of these three lads before. But 10 hours later, they would burn him alive. With their bellies full, the pubs open, and the first drink of the day calling their names, the boys began as they meant to go on. And with some cheeky banter, lewd jokes, and a smattering of naughty words, the boys had fun and were no bother to anyone. Roger Hammond was born on the 25th of April 1945 as one of five children, with two older sisters and two younger brothers. He lived, as he did up until his arrest, at 24 Donaldson Road in Kilburn. He was educated at Salisbury Road Secondary Modern, where he met Robert and David, and upon leaving school, he gained an apprenticeship as a cabinet maker, and he remained in that job for 6 years. Roger was a normal lad, a little loud, easily riled, and hot-tempered. But he had no debts, no drug issues, and no drink problem. He didn't consort with gangs, he had no criminal record, and no history of violence. Whilst in custody, being charged with murder, the police stated he was polite, helpful, and composed. And just like the other two lads, there was nothing in his life to suggest that he would become a killer. At 1 p.m, Reginald took his usual 4-minute stroll west to the Pen and Wig Club, an exclusive members-only club for journalists and lawyers. For lunch, he had two glasses of wine, a small plate of cheese sandwiches, some crisps, and returned to work by 2 p.m. You may ask why his lunch is so important to the case. But it is. Robert Alcock was born on the 31st of May 1944. As an adopted child raised with no siblings, although his foster parents were loving and caring, living just doors apart, he regarded his brothers as Roger and David. Leaving school, Robert tried his hand as a printer, a porter, and a postal clerk. But nothing held his interest like music. As a gifted musician, Robert formed a beat group called the In Crowd. He loved the job, the travel, the money, and being recently engaged, his life was good. Describing himself as a gentleman, in custody, the police corroborated this, stating that he was polite, intelligent, and cooperative. At 5 p.m, Reginald finished work for the Inland Revenue at Somerset House. Being a middle-aged man in a middle-class profession, he spoke well, walked tall, and dressed respectably. His smart black suit was starched, his white shirt was crisp, his handmade shoes gave a reassuring squeak, and it was all topped off with a black bowler hat. You may ask why the clothes he was wearing is so important to the case. But it is. David Hugman was born on the 26th of June 1946 in Southport, Lancashire. Like Robert, he was adopted, and being raised as an only child to two doting parents, his upbringing was happy. Leaving school, he was trained by his adoptive father as a fish merchant at Billingsgate Market, later promoted to salesman for CJ Noon Limited, where he was described as exceptionally good and completely trustworthy. And in custody, the police also stated that he was polite, cheerful, and alert. And as the evening rolled on, the jokes got dirtier, the banter got bawdier, and the booze flowed quicker. And although the lads were mostly moderate drinkers, having worked hard, they'd earned a day off, not just to celebrate their pal's 21st birthday, but also their lifelong friendship. Where Reginald went next, we don't know. Who he was with, we don't know. What he did between the hours of 5 p.m. and 7:30 p.m., we don't know. With nothing in his stomach but a few partially digested sandwiches and some crisps, we know he hadn't eaten since lunch. And with 299 milligrams of alcohol to 100 milliliters of blood in his system, we know that during those missing 2.5 hours, he drank the equivalent of 12 pints of beer. A considerable amount for an 11-stone man. Again, you may ask why what he drank is so important to the case. But it is. As all these details, the wind direction, the lack of rain, his clothes, his meals and his drink, all paint a picture of where he had been, what he had done, where he went next, and more importantly, why he ended up dead. At 6:30 p.m, Roger, Robert and David entered Lyle Street. They were 75 minutes away from killing Reginald West. But at no point during that day had they seen, spoken to, or even met their victim. They didn't even know that he existed until almost a week later. They were not crazed killers out for revenge. They were just stupid, drunk, horny young men looking for girls. 23 Lyle Street was inconspicuous. A four-story building set in a curved terrace with an electrical store called London Central Radio on the ground floor. With no signs, no flashing lights and no doorman, the upper floors were private flats used by sex workers, and on the first floor was a clip joint. Of course, you would only know that if you'd been there before and you knew what you were looking for. But the one thing that sex establishments don't scream is exactly that. Sex. To the right of the shop, under a tatty red awning, was an open door. Egging the other on, Roger walked in first, followed by Robert and David. With torn wallpaper, a musty smell, and their feet creaking under the tinder-dry steps as a northeasterly breeze whistled up the gloomy stairs and out of a slightly ajar window set with horizontal steel bars, the boys giggled, as so far, this was about as erotic as a prison. And the floors above were no better. As under the disconcerting boing of bed springs from the second floor flats, on an isolated landing was a toilet. So cramped you could barely turn, so dirty you'd rather hover than risk infection. As with a tiny barred window, screwed shut, and the door's lock prone to jam, often an unfortunate punter would be trapped inside this airless cesspit, their nose violated by the stench of unflushed piss and shit, until someone heard their cries and gave the door a good shove. Only the boys would never ascend that far. The first floor was split into two rooms, an outer room, barely 10 feet square and draped in tacky black velvet, faux silks, tatty lace and mildly erotic portraits of ladies in lingerie, and stood by a cash tin, the club's terms and conditions, and a coat rack, was a woman known only as Julie, whose real name was the even less alluring moniker of Griselda. With the club's door locked and the boys clearly sozzled, Julie took £5 off Roger to cover his tab. And with his pals being broke, Robert and David decided to wait outside, whilst the birthday boy entered the club. And sexual heaven. Of course, with it being a little after tea time, the club was dead. With their shift having barely begun, Betty, Margaret, Sylvia, Dell and Pauline weren't really in the mood. And like all clip joints, it was the oldest scam in the book. Three tatty sofas in a tiny empty room, with no alcohol, no dancing, no nudity, no sex, and charging an extortionate fee to let stupid drunk men walk in, stand about, and look dumb. After half an hour of boredom, Roger demanded his money back. But costing £2 to get in, 10 shillings to be served an alcohol-free drink, and £2.10 to make small talk with a fully dressed girl, under the terms and conditions which he had ignored, his £5 was spent. Feeling cheated, ashamed, and fleeced out of more money than he earned in a week, Roger's temper rose. Unwilling to back down, Roger and Julie argued it out. But as Roger's blood boiled, and with no doorman to boot the boozy boy out, Julie offered him half of his money back. Half. He wanted it all. Only with Sylvia exclaiming,
"Hey, your mates have gone up the street!"
Roger took half of what was his and gave chase to Robert and David. A few minutes later, Sylvia screamed,
"They're coming back!"
As storming up Lyle Street, she spied the boys. Roger playing the big man, as behind him, his pals cackled like schoolgirls. Sensing trouble, Sylvia locked the club's door, and like a pre-rehearsed battle plan, the girls dashed upstairs, past a stinky toilet, crawled out of an unbarred window, onto a flat roof out back, and waited in silence. One floor below, the girls heard banging, shouting and laughing, as Roger screamed,
"I want my money, all of it!"
Being terrified, the girls scraped together what little cash they had. And being the focus of his wrath, Sylvia climbed back inside and descended the stairs. But no sooner had it begun than it had ended. Peeping out of the stairwell, Sylvia spotted the boys fleeing west down Lyle Street. As in the peak of a petty childish tantrum, these grown men had emptied a full bin bag of dirty rubbish onto the stairs. The police were called, but with nothing damaged or stolen, no charges were made. Still being early into their shift, Sylvia and Margaret popped next door for dinner. Sandy and Jay were regaled with the evening's excitement. And although Vivian usually didn't let non-members in, especially one so sozzled who was clearly several pints worse for wear, being a well-dressed man in a smart suit, spectacles, hand-stitched shoes and a bowler hat, who was well-spoken and polite, she guided the blonde stranger upstairs to the club's toilet to spend a penny. It was just a quiet Monday evening. But the evening was far from over. At Lex Garages, three streets northwest, on the corner of Brewer Street and Lexington Street, three drunken lads, clutching a large Coleman's mustard tin, paid 2 shillings for half a gallon of petrol. And having grabbed another bin bag of rubbish, they stood in the doorway of 23 Lyle Street, laughing. As feeling cheated out of £2.10, the silly giggling lads unleashed a petty prank. They only wanted to scare the girls. They didn't want to hurt anyone. They said it was just a joke. At 7:30 p.m, sensing a dark acrid smoke and a soft distant crackling, Vivian peeped down to the street door to see the three lads from earlier, giggling naughtily, a new bin bag of rubbish strewn across the stairs, a sad little flame in a pile of crumpled newspapers. Before she could reprimand the pathetic little boys, Roger tipped the petrol tin onto the smouldering sack. And with a flash, a blast and a gasp, the doorway ignited, and the drunken lads darted off down the street, giggling with hilarity at their hilarious jape, unaware of what they had unleashed. As the stairwell filled with thick black smoke and deadly gases, Vivian ran into the club screaming,
"Fire! Fire!"
But with their only exit blocked by a raging inferno, as before, the girls crawled out of the unbarred upstairs window onto the flat roof and shouted down to the passers-by for help. And as the searing flames licked up the wooden walls and flicked out of the shattered windows like fiery tongues, the first floor of 23 Lyle Street was enveloped in seconds. The Soho Fire Brigade were called at 7:36 p.m. They arrived at 7:39 p.m. and the fire was out by 7:58 p.m. Fire Officer Eads said that being a mix of paper and petrol, the fire would have remained by the street door and burned itself out, causing minimal damage to just the ground floor. But with the flames being whipped up by a light northeasterly wind, as fresh oxygen whistled up towards the unbarred open window, the tinder-dry beams of the old wooden stairwell acted like a chimney flue, forcing the fire higher and faster, enveloping all four floors of the building with speed and ferocity. Thankfully, with two of the girls in a nearby restaurant and six rescued from the rooftop, miraculously, everyone inside 23 Lyle Street escaped unharmed. At least, that's what they thought. Obscured by the panic to escape, nobody heard him banging. Hidden by the thick plumes of black smoke, nobody saw him choking. And muffled by the frantic chaos on the roof, being trapped one floor below in a dirty, cramped toilet, nobody heard him screaming. Being barely 3 feet square, on either side of the frantic man were two intensely hot walls. So hot, its paint warped and peeled as he roasted inside. Behind was a small single window, its frame screwed shut and its horizontal steel bars too thin to crawl through. And in front, a thick wooden door, wedged shut, its lock jammed, as beyond it an inferno raged. And inside what had become his tiny coffin, all of his life-giving air was slowly replaced by heat, flames, and deadly gases. He had no way to escape. A few hours later, the charred body of 54-year-old Reginald Gordon West was found, slumped on the toilet floor. A once well-dressed man, now unrecognizable from the blackened walls. His skin scorched, his hair shriveled, and an acrid stench of seared flesh hung in the air, as the man had been burned alive. With his body so severely damaged that even his own baby brother couldn't recognize him, Reginald's identity was later confirmed by the contents of his wallet and the records of his Harley Street dentist. Believing it was little more than a harmless prank, 1 week later, the police issued identikit pictures of the three unknown men seen starting the fire. Seeing their faces in the papers, Roger Hammond, Robert Alcock, and David Hugman handed themselves in at West End Central Police Station. They made full confessions, and all three expressed their anxiety and upset at the death of Reginald West. Being tried at Bow Street Magistrates Court, on the 3rd of June 1966, all three pleaded not guilty to murder, but guilty to manslaughter. On the 14th of July 1966, Roger and Robert were sentenced to 2 years, and David to 21 months, which they all served at Wormwood Scrubs Prison. With both parents dead, George buried his only brother. Reginald was a good man, quiet, polite, and professional. A well-dressed and well-mannered civil servant, who after a hard day at work went out for a few drinks, and like any normal person, felt an overwhelming urge to empty his bladder. His death was truly senseless. He was an innocent man in the wrong place at the wrong time for an innocent reason, who was caught up in a childish prank by three drunken boys who had been conned by a simple scam. He never met his killers, he never saw his killers, and he never even knew they existed. Reginald West died a horrible, painful, and lonely death. Burned alive inside a dirty toilet in a seedy clip joint. And all because Roger felt cheated out of £2.10. And Reginald was desperate to spend a penny. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Don't forget, if you're a Murky Miler, to stay tuned for more extra goodies after the break. But before that, here's my recommended podcasts of the week, which are Getting Off and I Said Goddamn. Getting off, getting off.
Are you a true crime junkie that's looking for a different perspective?
Have you ever read about a famous case and wondered how it was possible that a defendant got acquitted?
Are you interested in criminal justice reform?
Do you often find yourself making extraordinarily inappropriate jokes while swearing like a sailor?
Then the Getting Off podcast is for you.
Hosted by us.
Two real live criminal defense attorneys.
Getting Off explains the legal reasons behind outcomes in famous trials and tackles tough topics in the world of crime and criminal justice.
We use first-hand sources like trial transcripts, police reports, crime scene photographs, and appeals briefs to give you the information that the public rarely hears about when it comes to the criminal justice system.
Our podcast isn't about carefully crafted musical interludes or obsessively edited narratives.
Instead, it is a no-holds-barred, unedited, raw legal presentation by two lawyers that have spent over a decade each in the trenches.
Previously covered cases include Casey Anthony, Michael Peterson, Jody Arias, and more.
Subscribe to the Getting Off podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Do that to get off now.
Hey, true crime listeners, check out our podcast, I Said Goddamn. We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by two besties who like to share messed up cases that make you say goddamn. Every Sunday, we try to one-up each other's story by sharing a horrific case the other has never heard of. Along the way, we splash in some wildly inappropriate jokes and colorful language. Listen every Sunday from any of your favorite podcast directories. Also, follow us on Twitter at ISGDPodcast or visit our website, ISGDPodcast.com.
A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who are Felicity Ellis, Eva R., David Sack, and Diane Rossiter, who will all receive handwritten thank you cards from me, as well as a little envelope full of Murder Mile goodies, and some patron-only ebooks, videos, and crime scene photos, all for as little as just $3 a month. Bargain. This week I'd like to do a little shout-out to Dan Horning of, pardon my pronunciation for this, Siri Morden Podden. It's a Swedish podcast about true crime. And also one of the podcast writers, Eva Martinson, who I both met on a Murder Mile walk recently, and they were an absolute delight. So a big shout-out to them. And if you've not read it already, Adam at the fabulous UK True Crime Podcast asked me to write a piece about Murder Mile for his blog. I've enclosed a link to it in the show notes. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And that is that. That's that done. Yay, up 60. Lovely. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. It's me. Hello, Michael. Hello. How are you? You all good? Hope you're all well. That's good. It's good. How long did that take? Oh, that was a little bit quicker than I thought. Good. That's nice. Right. Welcome to Extra Mile. If you've never been to Extra Mile before, obviously, this is the unscripted, unedited bit. There's no sound effects. There's no editing. Blah, blah, blah. This is just where I give you extra information about the case that you've just heard. But also, I go and open my windows and doors to let some air in. Because, because it's... it's warm and it's airless, and although it wasn't too bad today, there wasn't a man with an angle grinder outside making a bloody nuisance, and it's been quite quiet, so it's been easy to record this one. In fact, the only bit of fun that we had one boat go past, but I barely heard it because it had a quiet engine, and the other one was Mr. Weeds. Mr. Weeds is a man who goes out in a boat, and it's weird. It's like he's got a conveyor belt on the front, and what he does is he gets rid of all of the weeds on the top of the water, because there's a quite a prolific weed on the water that basically starves the water of oxygen. So he's out today clearing all that up. Anyway, I'm going to put my tea on. Coffee. I'm going to have coffee today. Have I done that? That's done. Got a Bakewell tart ready for when I finish. Proper Bakewell tart. Not a Mr. Kipling. Mr. Kipling's all right, but they've gone a bit small. Gone a bit tiny, they really have. So this is a Morrison's Bakewell tart. Just going to switch off a light. Morrison's Bakewell tart, they're like twice the size. They're nice and deep. The Franzi pan's good. There's enough jam in it. The icing's nice. The pastry's good. And there's always a glacé cherry, which is good. So, right, so we're waiting for my coffee to do. I'm going to have a coffee. It's meant to be like an Irish cream coffee. It just tastes like someone's put a bit of mint in it. And so we'll whisk through this. So, out of breath. So, where am I? I'm in Little Venice at the moment. I think I mentioned that last time. Little Venice, a place they call Little Venice because it has a canal, has one canal. Doesn't look like Venice at all. It has two bridges, four bridges. If I'm fair, apparently they call it Little Venice. It's not really Venice at all. Anyway, I'm going to move tomorrow. I'm going to move on to the east of London and go head out that way.
because I'm going to get the covers for my boat fitted. So I'm going to be up nice and early so I can get to the water point before everyone else gets there. And I'm going to empty my poo tank. Because obviously, when you have a doo-doo on a boat, obviously it can't go into the canal because you know there's wildlife in there and things like that. So it goes, either you, some boats have little cassettes, it's like a little drawer you put underneath your toilet, and like once a week you have to pull it out because you can fill up one of them quick. Or, like in mine, I have one that's like about, it's like a big old tank that has like 200 litre capacity or something like that. It's just a lot of poo. So tomorrow I get to go to the machine, I get like a big hose you put on, it builds up a suction, and then you open it up, and then you hear a, and then you watch, and it's, unfortunately, to make sure it's working that you're getting suction, it has to be a clear tank. So people walking past, and they look at you, and they go, they can see all of your poo being sucked out of the boat. But yeah, there's a lot of poo I need to get rid of. So anyway, all good, all good. So that was Ep 60, hope you enjoyed that. Just about to start writing episode 61, which I think is a nice one. I've done the research on that, so I think that might work. It might be a nice simple story. And then episode 62, I'm going to do as the boat going past a little bit too fast. So my boat might do a little bit of a bang here. He's going way too fast, and he's got a shit engine. Listen to that. Yeah. Oh, he's just decided to slow down a bit. Oh, no, he hasn't. He's decided to crack on. He has no idea, is he? Episode 62 will be the two-parter. So the original one that I was going to start the series with, but it wasn't a good episode. It was a really good episode. It was just, it's different to all the others. There's no sympathetic characters in it. So what I did was I focused on the investigation and how there was very little evidence for the police at the start. And this is, it's quite an interesting one to look at when people go, why aren't the police doing their job properly? Why can't the police solve the murder that happened to round here? And when the police turn up and speak to the neighbours go, I'm not talking to the police, it's up to you to solve it. And it's like, it's one of these kind of ones. So what I'm going to do, episode 62 will be a two-parter. So they will go out at the same time. So you'll wake up in the morning and go, oh, hang on, Michael sent two versions of the same. It's not. It will be episode 62A and episode 62B, and they will be marked part one and part two. And I'll clearly mark in them, this is a two-parter, for, because sometimes people message me and they go, What's going on? Why are you... I've listened to this bit and there's no ending. It's like, yeah, because it says part one, for fuck's sake. Anyway... Oh dear. Anyway, so that will be episode 62. So they will be going out the episode that I didn't get. But, and it is a good episode. It's nice. It's interesting. But it's very different to the other ones. Tea's up. Well, coffee's up. Oh. Here we go. Oh, it looks like a sludge. It's not even thick. It's not even thick and nice. It's just looks like a brown sludge. I'll drink it, I ain't got a problem with that. Oh, see, it smells nice, it just doesn't taste as nice as it smells. Anyway, it's a Kenko Irish coffee. It's not really Irish coffee. Anyway, I've got the other series coming up as well. They're looking really good. There's a nice mix in them. I'm mixing them up a little bit. There's some that I'd researched, and then some that I was unsure about, and then some I've pulled out, and then others I've kind of found this week. So I've got three new ones to start researching, because there were some new stories that I found. I thought, oh, that might make for a different mix, because you know me, I don't want you to kind of go, you know, if we have a dead prostitute one week, I don't give you dead prostitute next week. And if there's like a 1940s one week, I don't give you 1940s next week. I always do like, we have... 1940s dead prostitute, then we'll go for an assassination, and then I'll try and mix it up and move it around, and you know, so make it all nice and different. Anyway, this case kind of came out of nowhere, really. I think I was on the British newspaper archive just having a, sometimes, you know, it's nice to just kind of get an idea of what's out there, and sometimes I just do a trawl and go murder Soho and just trawl and just see what crops up, and there's normally a lot of crap. But this was just a tiny, tiny article. It really was tiny. There was really nothing about it, really. It just literally said, man burnt alive on a toilet. And I was like, that's interesting. You know? So I thought I'd give it a go. Dived in. Didn't know what it was. I thought, by the way that one of the newspapers had written it, it sounded like they were trying to get across the idea that it was a revenge attack. They wanted to make it more interesting than it was, but it wasn't. It was this case, which I kind of like in a way, because it's no, there's no killers in there. There's no revenge. It's too. A group of people who didn't know each other, and it's really is a series about, it's about fate, it's about, you know, chance. There's a lot of things that could have changed if the wind was a different direction. You know, no one would have died. If I'll go into it shortly, there's a chance that the boys couldn't have bought petrol if the boys hadn't decided to walk away and then Roger had to go and chase them. If they would have waited like about 2 minutes more, maybe the decision to give Roger back all of his money would have been decided, or if he would have just grown up and or read the bloody terms and conditions in first. This is like episode 64, sorry, 45. Do you remember with the Jamaican girl who came over and she became a hostess in the nightclub? And the unknown man, who still hasn't been found today, went into the nightclub. He was charged £5 to get in. There was no sexy dancing. There was no nudie ladies. There was no alcohol. And he was charged £250 to get out. This is the same kind of story. And literally with that one as well, it was like he had a chance to read the terms and conditions. They were there. The problem is that clip joins, it makes the club legal in the fact that the terms and conditions are clearly there. They're in big letters. You've just got to spend 5 minutes to go, oh, there's a service charge of £250. What does that mean? That means you've got to drink at least £250 worth, or we'll still charge you for it. It's, you know, but they prey on the fact that you're going to have stupid, horny men who've had a bit to drink who pay £5 and think they're going to go and see some boobies. Oh, dear Lord, what's the world coming to? Anyway, let's dive into some extra information. I was going to do normally what I do with the introduction, you know, I introduce a street, then I introduce the victim and their early life. But what I decided to do it in a different way with this one. So what I did was I did it from the brother's perspective, George Ellington West, who was his brother, who identified the body. I thought that was a nice way in. And then I introduced other elements about the victim by comparing him to the guys who killed him. So that's how I did it this time. But there were things that I obviously didn't include. So obviously Reginald Gordon West, he had one brother, George, who lived in Windsor, who identified his body. He was 54 years old, civil servant, as mentioned. He was born on the 29th of December 1911. His parents were Herbert George Gumbleton and Christina Margaret Gordon. So that's where you get Reginald's middle name being Gordon was from his mum, and George's first name was his father's middle name. But when they changed from Gumbleton to West, I don't know. I wasn't able to find that out. But it's not relevant for the story, so I didn't really focus too much in it. Very highly respectable family, educated. If you're a patron, if you're a patron supporter, I will be posting a photo, a rare photo that I found of the family. You can see exactly, it shows, excuse me, it shows Reginald when he was, I think he's about 5 or 6 years old, and then his brother is just a baby. In the picture is his mum and what I believe was his aunt. His father wasn't in the picture. His father came from Lambeth. Obviously, as mentioned, they had two children. They were married, and then given the dates, it literally is they were married on like 25th of March 1911, and then Reginald, their son, was born 29th of December. So literally married, devoutly religious, immediately had a baby. He was in the Royal Artillery. He died 6th of November 1961 in Windsor. And his wife, Christina, so the boy's mother, died same day as well. I've searched, this was going to be one of the stories that I put into it, but I can't find any information about how they died. I just know that they died and where they've been buried. But the rest of it is kind of irrelevant. They moved around a little bit. Obviously, the younger brother was raised in Melrose in Scotland. They're both about 5... I can't get this quite right. They were about 5'8", 5'9". Blonde, well-dressed. Reginald was old-fashioned, as mentioned. He wore a bowler hat. Obviously, this is the 1960s. He was dressed for the 1930s, 1940s, really. But he wore good shoes, handmade shoes, size 8. Fins by Horns, I didn't put that in. Nice brown wallet. Pretty much everything on him was well-to-do. So that was really useful for me because I could get very little information about where Reginald came from. That kind of became the key thing. So kind of the Pen and Wig Club, it's a members-only club. You know, you have to be of a certain echelon of society in order to get in. They don't just let anyone in. He had a cheque in his wallet for £25. That's a big old sum of cash. That's, what did we say before? £5 was about £100 today. So that's about £500 in his wallet. So, do you know, he's got a wallet in his pocket. He lived in Ruskin Park Road in Champion Hill, South London, quite a decent part of town, especially for, couldn't tell whether he was married, couldn't get any details about that. But he didn't seem to be married, didn't seem to have kids. But he lived in a nice place, good wristwatch. And then pretty much everything about him was good. The horn-rimmed glasses were good, so that was a good way in. And then because his pay slips were in his wallet, I know that Somerset House was kind of Inland Revenue and part of the Navy for a while as well, but that helped me work out that he worked for the Inland Revenue, which is very useful. So that was nice. His clothes and everything about him gave me more information than I could have got anywhere else. Ugh, yuck. So Roger James Hammond, 20, cabinet maker. These are the guys who caused the death of Reginald West. So Roger Hammond, 20, cabinet maker, as mentioned, born the 25th of April 1945 in Kilburn, had no prior convictions. As mentioned, he had a couple of injuries as a child. He got Still's disease, had to go to the handicap school. But, you know, he had some problems as a kid, but he had a relatively good life. Do you know, he managed to fight his way through it. A little bit hot-tempered. But apart from that, do you know what? He'd been in the same job for 6 years, which is great. He'd left school. He got an apprenticeship as a cabinet maker. And that was over in Camden. He started on about £4 a week. By the time of his arrest, he was earning about £13 a week, which is not too bad. And he'd been there for 6 years, and he enjoyed the job. Single man, lived with his mum. His parents had separated. They divorced about a year before this murder, but his dad lived around the corner, was pretty local, and he'd got two older sisters and two younger brothers. What else is in there that's useful? I think I covered everything with that. They gave all these guys like a psychological profile. They sat down with them, they went through their history. They all said, all nice guys, no hints of mental disease, average intelligence. All of them expressed regret and concern for what had happened, and even Roger said a couple of times in his assessment, he kept saying, you know, I'm really upset for what has happened, and I'm not trying to excuse myself. He was honest about it. He said, you know, my actions caused this, as did all the other boys as well. So Roger Alcock, who's the other one, who's the musician, same again, good background. Didn't hang out with bad people. His mum was a housewife. He was adopted, but his mum was a housewife. His father ran a car and a betting business. he tried a couple of, as mentioned, he tried a couple of industries on the way in. You know, he just left school. This was kind of the era where, you know, you had to knuckle down and get yourself a 9-to-5 job, clock in and clock out, and all that crap. He got an apprenticeship as a compositor for a printer's in Northwest London. Didn't really enjoy that. He left it to better himself. He worked for a tailor's for a bit. He was a postal clerk. Became an apprentice cutter. That was at the tailor's. He was dismissed for bad timekeeping. So not particularly bad, but he didn't enjoy the job. He had a series of vague jobs: hospital porter, labourer. But when he really loved music, he went to art school. He set up a club called the In Crowd. He was briefly managed for a while, and he used to play clubs mostly around North London. There was a club called the Noriet Club in Seven Sisters Road. That was kind of his main haunt, but he would travel around a lot, and he really enjoyed it. He was engaged at the time, said he enjoyed what he did. He was a gentleman. He didn't like violence. Police said he was polite and cooperative in custody. He complained of depression and feeling dejected. This was whilst in custody, and became tearful when discussing the offence. He had a strong sense of guilt and suicidal thoughts and wished he had died instead of the innocent victim. David Hugman, the other one, he was a fish salesman. They're all just very ordinary boys. There's really unremarkable stories. He got a job as a sales assistant at Montague Burton in Kilburn High Road. Didn't really enjoy that. Went into business with his dad. His dad was already a fish merchant at Billingsgate Market. Worked his way up through the echelons. I don't think it was really his thing. They said his work was satisfactory, but do you know what? It was paying him a wage. He got through to be a trainee salesman at another fish merchant's and was promoted to salesman and office clerk. He was on about £20 a week, which, as we've just mentioned, that's not bad, actually. And was described as exceptionally good, completely trustworthy and very capable. And these are all at the time of his arrest. Anything else in there that's interesting? No, not really. Yeah, no, all good. So, as mentioned, we got the possessions that were found on Reginald West all became really useful. But as mentioned before, the police couldn't just assume that because the wallet was on the body, that the wallet belongs to the body. They can't make those leaps. It's like we could. We'd go, oh, well, the wallet was in there, so that's Michael's wallet, so that must be the body of Michael. But police can't do that. You have to get it. You have to get exactly right. Because what about if this guy wasn't Reginald? What about if he was a mugger and Reginald had been mugged, left for dead somewhere else? Or... you know, whatever, and this guy accidentally had been burnt to death. So it might not be Reginald, but they had to check. They were pretty certain it was, but coffee's awful. So they had all the things in his wallet, which was great. You know, it was inside his jacket, and even though it was intensely hot in there and his flesh was searing and all that, you know, a lot of that didn't get damaged. It was inside a leather wallet, and the leather actually protected a lot of the documents, which was really useful. But in there, of course, as mentioned, he also had some ballpoints, a white handkerchief, three keys in a leather case, which they later checked belonged to his flat, the white metal wrist watch with the glass broken, the face was smashed, and it stopped exactly at 7:35 p.m. So that would be at the intensity of the heat of the fire when it had killed him, caused his watch to stop as well. Obviously, as mentioned, the boys kind of set the fire off. It was just meant to be a prank. They ran away. They thought it was just a small fire which could easily be put out and that no one would be harmed. Even though Roger Hammond had written in the club's signing in book, he'd written his name, it was an illegible scrawl. Literally, he'd just written Roger and then he'd signed. So the police were unable to track him down because of that. May the 1st, 1966, so that's almost a week later, the police issued identikit pictures of the three men based, because don't forget there were six ladies there who'd seen their faces, so they were able to identify. The identikits are pretty good. They were issued. Important to point out, so we've heard about identikit before. If you don't know about identikit is, in the old days, what they used to do was they used to sit like a victim down and go, okay, describe the man. And you go, oh, he's got brown hair and big nose and, you know, like that. And then you'd get lots of different people together who'd seen the same person. You put the sketches together, and based on the quality of the artist and the quality of the information the artist has given, you could have entirely different pictures. It was really random and it didn't always work. So it was a system that was brought in called identikit, where you have very standardized pieces of it's like an earlier version of eFit that they use now, which is pieces of forehead, pieces of nose, pieces of ears, but they're all standardized. So basically someone could go, no, the ears are bigger, the ears are a bit pointier, and they just put them in, so it makes it actually a bit more of a formula, but that way you actually get a clearer description of what these people actually look like. So identikit was actually used in a case just two streets away from where we are now on Lyle Street, and just 2 years prior. And if you listen back to that episode, that's episode 7, which is the identikit killing in the old curiosity shop. That's the one where the young lad steals a ceremonial sword worth £15 so he can sell it to buy an engagement ring for his girlfriend. And he kills the lady who is looking after the shop there. He kills her and flees. And this was one of those cases that was kind of interesting, because if he just would have gone in there and killed the lady, he would have got a life sentence. If he would have just gone in there and stolen the sword, he probably would have got about 5 to 10 years and then been released. But because he went in there and killed her with one of her own swords that were in the shop, and then he took the sword, that meant that he qualified for the death penalty. Whereas if he hadn't stolen the sword, it just would have been a life sentence. This case, just in case you're wondering, this is 1966. So the abolition of the death penalty came in 1960/61. That's went through the House of Lords, and then they had about 4 or 5 years of kind of working it through. So the death penalty in the death penalty in England and Wales wasn't abolished until 1965. And this is 1966. So even though these boys had been found guilty of manslaughter, if they had been found of murder, which this wasn't, they wouldn't have got the death penalty, A, because the death penalty had been abolished, and B, they hadn't stolen anything. In fact, it was the opposite. Roger felt he'd been stolen from. Whew! Right. Whew, that's a lot of breath I expelled then. One thing I didn't go through in here was... obviously, when they went to get the petrol, we got a statement here from Ernest Alfred Wells, who was the forecourt attendant employed at Lex Garages at number 2 Lexington Street. You've heard about Lexington Street before. That was in the episodes 8 and 9, the Ginger Ray case. So she was on... Oh, come on, brain work. Broadwick Street. She was the prostitute, remember the really nice one, with the red hair, who used to treat all the homeless kids to sweets, and that's, she kind of funded Feckler's boyfriends as well. And she would walk from Broadwick Street to Brewer Street down Lexington Street, so that's where you've heard that before. What's that guy? The mad Russian guy, the mad German guy who cut his mate's cock off, William. Oh, I think it's like episode 12 or something. Anyway, that's down there as well. But interestingly, I go past this place all the time. It's on Lexington Street. It's an old garage. It's like a multi-story garage at the moment, but it's white and it's Art Deco. And if you go past it, it's right on Brewer Street. It's right by all the sexy lady shops. And if you walk past it, you'll see it, and it looks really nice. They probably won't knock it down because it's really nice, but it's the Art Deco garage, and that's where the garage was. That's where they got it from. So that's literally one street west of Old Compton Street, and it's one street west of Peter Street, where Jacqueline Birren was murdered as well. So that's the last week before's episode. Oh dear. Anyway, they were there. That was the garage. They went there. One of the exhibits in the case was exhibit 9, the evidence. That was a burnt mustard can. But I didn't go into this because it slowed down the story. But on that evening, the 25th of April, Alfred Wells, the forecourt attendant, he said he served some boys who turned up wanting to get some petrol in a can. They hadn't got any cans available, because obviously you could buy a can and then you could fill it up with petrol. They hadn't got any available, and the young boys wanted some fuel, so they went off and they found a wine bottle, and they turned up with it, and Alfred went, no, I can't give you wine in a wine bottle. So they went away. It looks like they'd gone round some bins and stuff like that, and they managed to find a Coleman's mustard tin. So a big old mustard tin, a decent sized one. It was empty. They cleaned it out. It got a lid on it. He was happy. It was a metal tin with mustard on it. He sold them 2 shillings worth of petrol, which was roughly around half a gallon of petrol. And then they went off and caused the death of Reginald West. Post-mortem was conducted by Dr. Donald Tier. He has cropped up several times in here because he was the Westminster pathologist at the time. So that was on the same day. It was at Westminster Mortuary. I could barely say those words. Body was severely damaged by fire. I will be putting a photo on the Patreon page. I will put it hidden. It's in there, and you can make the decision whether you look at it or not. But it was one of those photos I looked at and went, where's the victim? And then I went, oh, shit, there he is. With this fire, the pathologist was unable to determine. He definitely died of asphyxiation. That was what had killed him, not the flames. He hadn't burnt to death, but it was the asphyxiation that killed him first, as with a lot of fires. And then the fire... It caused all the damage to him, but they were unable to determine whether he was conscious or unconscious at the start of the fire. So by the time the flames had been licking up, As mentioned, the body was identified by his brother. He was unable to confidently identify the body as that of his brother. He looked at a pair of gent's shoes and spectacles, which he said were similar to those of his brother, what his brother wore, that's not even good English, and some personal documents too. In those personal documents were obviously his payslips, and George's passport was there as well. They could see his name and his picture on there, but still, they couldn't use that as absolute hard evidence. You have to have someone to come in and go, I identify that body. What they did was they managed to find his dentist, who was Edward McKinn Sycamore at number 113 Harley Street. Told me a lot about who Reginald was. If he had a... obviously, Harley Street is where all the posh doctors are. Well, we say posh doctors. At the moment, it's really... Most of it is really just kind of people renting out places and conning people into believing that they're good, respectable, amazing doctors simply because they're on Harley Street. Because everyone goes, oh, it's a Harley Street doctor, and they don't realise that literally anyone can rent a place with enough money on Harley Street. It's a con. There are some good doctors on there, though. Anyway, he was at 113 Harley Street. Reginald had been his patient since 1955, so that was 11 years. He examined the badly burned body at Westminster Mortuary. I'm sure that most dentists, it's something that they don't think they're ever going to have to do. He saw the dental work and he was able to confirm that that was Reginald West. That's how they proved it was him. As mentioned, the trial was held at Bow Street Magistrates Court on the 3rd of June 1966. Hammond and Hugman, through their solicitor, pleaded not guilty, and they reserved their right for defence. And Alcock, through his solicitor as well, said, I have nothing to say at this stage. They were all granted legal aid, which means that the state paid for their legal costs. One thing that was part of the case that I didn't go into, because it's just really dull, to be honest. Mrs. R. Cohen, who ran London Central Radio and Electrical Stores on the ground floor of 23 Lyle Street. Obviously, she lost loads of business because the building caught fire and her shop caught fire as well. It was loads of papers about it. I couldn't be asked to read them. I was like, I had a flick through and I was like, meh, boring. 14th of July, they were all sentenced, all charged with manslaughter, all served at Wormwood Scrubs. Originally... Alcock and Hammond, so Roger and Robert, originally were sentenced to 4 years, but because they'd no prior convictions and they all admitted guilt to manslaughter and were, you know, very helpful to the police, that was reduced to 2 years. And David Hugman's was reduced to 21 months. Oh dear. So that was that. Did you enjoy that? Was it good? I'm out of breath now. Having my coffee. Looking for... This cake is staring at me. Look at it. I've already had one this morning. Can't wait. I'm going to have another. So that was that. That was episode 60. Hope you enjoyed that. I am heading off to the laundry now. That's how exciting my life is. Wow. Before I disappear off tomorrow. I was actually racing to get this episode done because it's going to piddle down with rain shortly, and because the roof of the boat is steel, like if you get a tiny bit of rain it goes pah, 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 and if the rain's really heavy you can't hear anything, which is nice, do you know, when you're lying in bed. I love that sometimes you're lying in bed and it's nice and peaceful and there's a gentle rocking of the boat as you kind of go into sleep, and when it starts to rain you can hear it. It's really nice, but it's not good when you're trying to write an episode or you're trying to record an episode. So that's done, that's good. I'm going to edit this today. I'm going to finish editing it tomorrow. It normally takes about 3 days to edit because they're pretty complicated edits, but hopefully you enjoy them. Hopefully you can hear all of the sounds in there. I was just going to say you can listen to this however you want, really, but some people did message me and say someone did message me and say, oh, I didn't realize that there was a soundtrack in the background. And when I quizzed them about it, I realised that they were actually listening to it. I record this with inner ear earphones. And the sound is deliberately meant to be subtle. I don't like it to be too heavy. So, you know, there's music in there, but there's also sound effects as well. And if you hear all that, great. But if you're listening to it, like on a... what's it called? Like a hands-free speaker or something like that. I'm not hip. I'm not with the kids. I don't understand. You might not hear all the noises if you've got a mono speaker. You might not hear it as well. Or, do you know, it doesn't. You don't have to listen to it with good earphones. But just to say, if you do listen to it with inner earphones, you'll probably hear more sounds. The more in there than anyone else will hear. And there's little things that I deliberately put in. Like sometimes I spend hours like really tweaking little different sounds. There were some that I put in the last couple of episodes that I can't explain them to you because it's like I don't know how I'm going to edit this episode, so I can't explain how. You know, but there are things that I put in there that are really good fun that I enjoy editing, and I sit there going, oh, I hope everyone hears that, but I know that most people won't. But if you want to, if you do get a pair of inner earphones and you want to, have a listen to some of the older episodes, or go back and listen to some old ones, and then you'll hear some of the things that I've put in. There's things that I put in there deliberately. I try and make them a little bit subconscious in there, like last time with the last week's episode, so the Daisy Wallace one, I set up in advance so you knew where you were by the sound, because you'd hear the phone ringing, you'd hear the typewriter, you'd hear the sewing machine, you'd hear the tailor sounds, and they're all in there, and the rumble of the tube train, so you knew you were in Holborn. But what I started doing, I started tweaking with the sounds later on. So the nearer we get to a murder, sometimes, you know, like the phone ringing is reversed. So I deliberately throw things in to make it to throw things slightly off key, just a little bit. So hopefully, whether you hear it or not, or whether you consciously hear it, hopefully your brain hears it and it goes, ooh, something's going wrong there. Or with the Jacqueline Bibby one, you know, I had a lot of fun using the different sounds in there. And there's one bit that I really liked. I put it in at the last minute, and it's where at the start, when I can't remember the name of the guy, where he meets Jacqueline Bibby and she goes to take the other pound note off him, and she goes, "Is that for me?" like that. And I didn't like it when I recorded it. I thought, "Oh, I don't like the way I've done that voice. I might have to change that." But I tweaked with it a little bit, and then I was like, I started putting it in. I started doing what they call a pull stretch, which is basically you take a piece of sound and you elongate it. So if it's that for me, so that's barely a second. But if I can elongate that to 3, 5, or sometimes 10 seconds, it's the same sound, but it's just it's longer. So it's like, is that, it's got a really drunken drawl to it, and I love that. So I put that in there, and then at one key point in episode 58, I put in very quietly Jacqueline Bibby, or me as Jacqueline Bibby, really going, "Is that for me?" And it was at the right point. I was like, "Oh, I'm really happy with that." I was happy with that. I'd thrown it in just to position it, and it was really good. I have to say that was a difficult episode to edit. I don't normally talk about the edit, because by the time you hear this, you've already heard the full episode, but I haven't started editing it yet. But the Jacqueline Bibby one was interesting. I got halfway through it, and I was like, "Oh, I don't know how to edit this. It's getting complicated." And I sat down and thought, because obviously I have to do this based off battery power, because I haven't got mains power. So I have to look at my battery and go, "Oh, shit, I've got 40% left. Right, what am I going to do?" And I thought, bollocks, I'm just going to go gonzo with it. So I deliberately, got all my sounds, and I just pushed them all in. And I was like, "Right, what are we going to do?" And I had a lot of fun with it. And a couple of hours later, I was like, "Oh, this sounds really good now." So we'll see how this episode goes. I'm hoping I'll do an episode soon where it's just nice and simple. I might do that, yeah. I've got one coming up soon, which I think the next week's one I'm writing will be quite simple, I think. I'm going to deliberately make it simple. Anyway, waffle over. Oh, that was waffle overload, wasn't it? That was waffle with maple syrup on it, and maybe some chocolate and some whipped cream and some sprinkles and some banana. God, I'm getting hungry now. Right, so I'm off to do the laundry. I'm off to wash my smalls and my new bed sheets, and everything's all exciting. So, hope you enjoyed that, and hope to hear from you soon. Lots of love. Oh, buy some mugs if you want to buy mugs. We've got loads of new mugs in, and everyone who buys a mug gets a Murky Miler badge. Yeah, I know, very exciting. Right, that's me done. Off to the laundry. Have fun. Bye!
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.